Hi, I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay, the podcast where each week we do a conversational deep dive analysis into a film. Today we are talking about Black Swan, the 2010 film directed by Darren Aronofsky, screenplay by Mark Heyman, Andre Hines, and John McLaughlin. I'm joined today by part of the Beyond the Screenplay team, Brian Bittner.
Hello, hello.
And Alex Cayeros.
Hello.
And joining us once again is fellow YouTube video essayist, writer, actor, Maggie Mae Fish. Thank you for joining us.
Hello. Thank you for having me for this gruesome tale.
Yes. Yes, we were just joking off mic about how apparently we only bring you in to talk about movies that have to do with like descents into madness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what are you trying to say? What are you saying? What are you saying about yourself as a fellow YouTuber?
These are the real questions. Yes. We're talking about Black Swan. Last week, we talked about Whiplash because there's a Lessons from the Screenplay video that is comparing these two films. And it was one of the early videos that I made on the channel. It was a lot of fun. It was a fan favorite. And so it's been fun revisiting these films because I hadn't seen them since making that video back then. Watching Black Swan again confirmed for me that I really enjoy this movie. Like, it's just such a ride of insanity. Like, it's so much fun to watch Nina go crazy, and it's disturbing in all the ways that it should be disturbing and unsettling. And I love how the filmmaking puts you into her headspace and all the stuff. I love this movie. I remember Alex watching it with you. There's like a common theme on the podcast where Alex and I have watched a lot of movies together. But Alex, I feel like we saw it at the Arclight, and it might have been my first Arclight movie.
Whoa. That's a good first Arclight movie.
I was definitely, won over immediately with with
the
that
sound.
Film Arclight.
The sound in this movie in a good theater is amazing.
Right.
Yeah. So I really enjoyed the movie. Alex, I know you love the movie. We'll get to you. But I want to hear from you, Maggie. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on this movie? What was your first viewing, if you remember it? How have your thoughts on it changed? Mm-hmm. Tell me about your relationship to Black Swan.
Yes, yes. I feel like the first time I watched it is probably a very universal experience. I say this knowing that my sister had the exact same experience that I did while we were living in separate states, where we watched this movie and we're like, oh, we might be gay, or at least a little bit. And quite honestly, for a lot of women, I think this is that movie. One, because as we mentioned right before we started recording, it is surprisingly very sexy and very like effective, you know, when it is trying to present that. And also it was like ballet, so like every girl went to see it just because, you know, how often do you get, you know, like a freaky ballet drama? So yeah, I mean, so that was the first time I had ever seen it. Yes, rewatching though, the thing that really surprised me, I guess, is it's like so structured for it being, you know, very like, you know, we think of it as like, yes, this descent into madness. But as I was watching, I was like, man, this is like a producer's dream. Like, like the ballet guy, he says about like five times, I need to see your Black Swan. And like that, like really just everything is like nailed home. A lot of lines that are, you know, I think maybe even now would have probably been like subtext or just like text, like, like, oh, did you have like a leslie dream about me? Like everything is very like said out loud, which like, you know, in that regard is a very clear movie. It's very clear and very effective. Yeah, because everything is so clear, you know, he's able to have those like, I call it like the baby throwing moments from his mother when he, you know, like, spoiler alert. But, you know, those very like viscerally effective parts of the film, because, yeah, everything else is just like, oh, yeah, you know, they even say in the beginning, you know, the swan dies at the end. So, you know, it's very,
right,
very set up, which is not a bad thing. Yeah. Again, if I was a producer, I'd be like, oh, great. You know, let's go. But, you know, that's also, yeah, it's not a bad thing. I mean, it's so iconic. You remember exactly what Black Swan is. And I think, again, yeah, it's in a way very clear movie while also being, you know, not that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think all of that helps make it so accessible. And I think that's why it was like successful and like was popular among people. Cause it's like you're saying that the basic, you know, parable story is there on the surface. It's very clear. It's sort of telegraphed from the beginning. Mm-hmm. This is what this is about. But the experience of the movie isn't about, you know, decoding what the plot is.
Right.
We talked about this maybe a little bit on Titanic. We've talked about it in general, but like sometimes having a movie's structure be just very clear and simple lets the audience like not have to worry about that and then be mm-hmm. able to lean into just the emotional, you know, experience of all of that.
To the were-swan story.
Wow.
Oh, like werewolf.
Were-swan.
Swan. Yeah.
That's what Aronofsky calls it. It's a were-swan story.
It's a were-swan story. Love it.
Wow. He's cute.
It's also a movie where like the setting and the story world like allows for just sort of no subtext. Like this isn't, you know, a family sitting around the dinner table, like quietly saying what they feel about each other. Like this is just people who have egos and are like, got to get stuff done. And like, they don't have time to engage in subtext and that kind of thing, which I think helps it feel like it's not just poorly written. It feels like, no, these are how these characters would talk in the story world.
Yeah. And yeah, it feels more sharp than like a meandering. Yes. Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It feels very intentional, very like soap opera-y, like at times, but again, like a kind. Right. Yes. Yeah. Kind of fits.
But I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Well, so Brian, did you see it when it came out? Did you see it in theaters? What was your first?
I definitely didn't see it in theater, but I definitely did see it at some point in that first, you know, chunk of time that it was out, that first year or something. And I was looking at Aronofsky's filmography and I was like, you know, all the that first five, like Pi through Black Swan, it's like all of them I saw around the time they came out, thought, wow, that was a really good movie. Like, it's my kind of thing. I like that it's like dark and artsy and stuff. Some of them, like I went and bought the Blu-ray and then I never watched any of them again. I just realized, I was like, I've never actually rewatched any of these movies, but like I also remember them really well, which is interesting. So it was really nice to revisit Black Swan and, you know, knowing what it was and be able to like appreciate everything about it. But also, I haven't seen it in 10 years, presumably. And I felt like I remembered everything, like maybe not some of the smaller things, but like it's just such a it's such an explosive movie and such a visual movie and such a, I don't know, emotional is not the right word, but it's just like it's like a stirring movie that like I just remembered all of these like shots and moments and that kind of thing. Like when she's looking at the paintings for the first time, I was like, one of them's going to look at her. I remember this from 10 years ago. And yeah, I really like the movie. And we can get into why, but I like that, you know, obviously it's this movie about these two sides of things, you know, as you were saying, I'm not kissing the white swan. I'm also kissing the black swan. Four times in the first 20 minutes of the movie, I counted. Even just by nature of what it is. It's like, this isn't a movie for people who want to see ballerina movies, but also people who want to see like dark, weird horror movies probably don't want to see a ballerina movie. And it's like, by its nature, it is this sort of light and dark thing. Which then you get, obviously, with the Natalie Portman character and the Mila Kunis character and who the Natalie Portman character is transforming into and all that stuff. So obviously the major theme of this movie, which we will talk about a ton, but it's, yeah, it's just something that like that also is a very simple thing, right? Just like light and dark and like how you embrace those or engage with those and that kind of thing. So it's like all the stage is set up for literally for the movie to get dark and weird and interesting because everything else is sort of so simple and not surface level, but there's not, it's not trying to be complicated in just like the machinations of what the movie is.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll definitely get into all of that, but Alex, I want to hear from you. Tell me about your relationship with Black Swan.
I mean, I just fucking love this movie. Like, I love this movie so much. I mean, part of it was that first impression, because it was early years in LA, going to the ArcLight Hollywood, and it was in, you know, one of their bigger theaters with the crazy, you know, the sound is turned up to like maximum, like before it's painful, but it's not quite painful. It's like almost at the edge there. And this movie, when you see it in that setting, is an experience. You know, it's like Darren Aronofsky is not subtle with this movie.
Right.
Like, this movie is big. It's big in every single way. It just reminded me like what I love about seeing a movie in a movie theater. You know, it's that kind of all enveloping, cathartic, insane, rapturous experience. And it's like what I want, basically. He gave me what I wanted from going to movie theaters. So I already am just happy. And then the more I revisited it, the more I just appreciated, like we've been talking about, what a beautiful blend it is. It's both going to these kind of crazy David Cronenberg body horror places, total like nuts, insanity, hallucinatory descent into madness. Yet it's also very accessible. Yet it also is very well structured. Yet it also is just, you know, it's doing fun stuff with its production design. And it just seems like it's just firing on all cylinders and unafraid and unembarrassed about being big and being melodramatic and being too much. You know, like it's okay with all that.
To your point, I was going to say, I think at the midpoint is when Natalie Portman's character says no to her mom and shuts the door. And it's like, it's very technical, but also, of course, yes, like that makes the most sense for, you know, the movie. Yeah.
Right. So, and so it kind of hits my sweet spot because I appreciate movies that can be accessed by anyone, that do speak the language that we're all used to in watching a story unfold, and yet can push the audience to like uncomfortable places and push the boundaries of like what we're going to be able to deal with to take us to that like crazy cathartic finale where it's just like overwhelming. Mm-hmm. I've always appreciated Aronofsky and of course Requiem for a Dream. I saw like in high school and I was like, whoa, that made me feel ill and I want to throw up now, but it's amazing. Like a director did that to me. The Fountain, for its kind of some of his weird flaws, you know, when I saw that in theaters, that kind of gave me kind of this whoa experience. Like I just like went on a trip and that was nuts. And Black Swan feels like kind of this culmination of different parts of Aronofsky, because, you know, in The Fountain, it's a movie that he had like storyboarded and like done a graphic novel about before he even made it, because it took so long to get financed and produced. So you can feel in that movie, every shot is really like exactly framed. And he's like, the present day is all squares and like all the, it's all square windows and the past is triangles and the future is spheres. And it's all like, it's almost too much like
high concept-y
perfection and symbolism. In a way, it's almost there in the theme of Black Swan, of the marriage of the looseness and the perfection. But it feels like there's something in Black Swan that is a marriage of like the Requiem messiness and the Fountain perfection, which is, you know, you do have this really kind of aggressive commitment to every set, like setting is black and white and all the costumes are black and white. And there's these exceptions of like pink and greens in Nita's apartment. And there's the really rigorous attention to detail, but then the whole thing is shot handheld and the whole thing is super 16 millimeter and like verite style. And yet it's a very like intentional verite. It's not a messy, we'll fix it in post verite. It's like every shot feels intentional. So it just, it feels like this amazing, like what the characters have to do in the movie, it's this blend of loose and tight. And and it just, yeah, it just, it's my favorite of his movies because it does feel like it brings the best parts of him together, the parts that I appreciate the most, all together into one film.
Right. I think the best example of that is the handheld scenes on stage where everyone is dancing and the camera is zooming around and it's like, it feels so messy and chaotic. But then you think about the like care and precision that had to go into that to actually capture that.
Well, the moments that it's catching are like, you know, it's catching all the right angles of the faces for the what's being played in that moment, which is very precise actually, but it feels effortless and fluid.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I love this movie.
I was just going to add to your point that the way that Darren Aronofsky utilizes the more like horror aspects and, you know, when he start, like, it almost makes it easier to like identify with, because, you know, it's that abstraction of like, we know it's not really about ballet, but like, it's also really, really not about ballet. And that, you know, gives you room to apply it to so many things. And not to, again, compare it to Whiplash, but Whiplash in contrast is very much like in reality, in the moment. So with that movie, at least in my experience, I know a few jazz people who like don't like that movie because of the depictions of things where it's like, it's a lot easier to do because there's no abstraction. You know, if they had made anything bigger or larger than life, those things wouldn't have mattered as much. And you can kind of, you know, reap larger implications from it. Whereas this is like, you know, threading those together to make something bigger than what it is.
Right.
Right. It's kind of okay if ballet isn't perfectly represented because we're seeing it through the perspective of somebody going insane and losing their, becoming a literal swan.
This is the only time I thought of it when I was watching it. It reminded me more of Birdman than, especially with like the ending. I was like, oh, okay, that, you know, like that to me, you know, was again very much like taking the literal and kind of zhuzhing it up for effect.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Yeah, it's funny how like this movie is so unlike Whiplash in the sense that like the tone and the plot and all that kind of stuff are so different. And yet almost every like external plot point or sort of surface level plot point is exactly the same. You have this good protagonist who goes through this dark transition to basically ruin their real life to become this like dark success at the end. You have this problematic mentor who basically has very strange ways of getting, of trying to get the best out of their performers. And then obviously it's this competition set in this world where, and then also this relationship with the parent figure who they don't want to be like. And then it's also every other supporting character is just the other people in this story world, basically, who are competing for attention and trying to be perfect and trying to be the best. And then you even get the shots like the little slipper shots and stuff, just like a Whiplash. You get the spit coming out of the valve, and like it's there's like so many things that feel so similar for two movies that are that like couldn't be more different.
The gruesome details,
right?
Yeah. So something that is different that popped into my head while you were just laying all that out is that both movies do have a competitor person that's coming in to replace, you know, the protagonist, right? Or threatening to replace it. But it's interesting because in Whiplash, Ryan Connolly is his name, right? I feel like he's just there to cause problems for our hero. But in Black Swan, the relationship between Nina and Mila Kunis's character,
Lily,
thank you, is more complicated, where it's like Nina's threatened by her, but also she embodies everything that Nina needs to be in order to become the Black Swan. And so there's this weird tension of kind of an attraction of like, I want to be you, but also I'm threatened by you. And I feel like a lot of, especially the middle of the movie, part of what keeps it so interesting is watching that dynamic and watching Nina wrestle with all of that, and why the crazy night out that they have where they run into the Winter Soldier and the club. And it's a difference between them that I think helps so much signal where Nina's head is at and how she's slowly transforming herself from White Swan to Black Swan. And then the movie just has so much fun with the playing around with like, which part of that was real? Which part did you make up? Like, it's, yeah, I love throughout the movie how it does that and just very deftly navigates. You're never quite sure what's real and what isn't, but somehow by the end, you feel like you retrospectively can understand what actually happened. And I feel like that's a hard thing to pull off, where you're not, the movie isn't just completely cheating. It all does add up and can be put together so that you have an understanding of what happened in reality, but you also understand the headspace the character was in the whole time.
Yeah, that's like the other directors have said this, I'm sure, but Rian Johnson has said it recently. They're like not tricking your audience. And Darren Aronofsky is absolutely a director that doesn't feel the need and probably doesn't want to, you know, do any sort of like trickery. Yeah, to like show you one thing, but it was actually another. Like, I think he would agree that, yeah, that like cheapens your experience. And, you know, sometimes when that happens, it feels like the director isn't respecting you as a, an audience member. Or yeah, like this is like seamless with, you know, with the reality and non-reality. And also I was going to add that a lot of this movie, like we said earlier, is like straightforward. And so in that way, some things end up being kind of simplistic, you know, like the, oh, you're old, that's why you're being replaced. You know, some things are reduced to like more straight or, you know, shorthand. But the relationship between, Nina and Mila Kunis, I don't remember.
Lily.
Yeah, like that was beautifully complicated.
Yeah.
And so I like that the movie spends like that much time like digging it. Cause that, yeah, that's one of the only movies that really like Jennifer's Body somewhat kind of, you know, has peaks into that similar theme, especially how like women are pitted against each other and how like they compete. Yeah. I mean, so for all the things that are, again, very like straight and straightforward, their relationship is so engaging to watch, especially as she's losing her mind at the same time.
Right. Right.
Yeah, I love the design of Lily's character. It's so perfect that she's from San Francisco. You know, it's like there's kind of like the uptight New York Nina, and then there's the loose, you know, let's roll on some Molly San Franciscan.
Right.
What's interesting about her character is she genuinely does seem to have some empathy for Nina and actually is trying to offer her some advice at times. Maybe it's all part of a plot to replace her eventually, but in the moment, she is offering like to be her friend and to be there when she is kind of at her lowest moments with the with Vincent Cassell. That's what makes their relationship interesting. It's not just a one note, we're competitors and now like we're hate fucking or something. It's like there's actually reasons for them to be drawn to each other and for Nina to genuinely kind of want to be like her. Yeah, there's reasons for us to kind of want them to be friends.
Yeah, I think back to what Michael was saying about sort of the movie not feeling like cheap in the way that it plays with reality and surreality. It's like you don't get this big reveal at the end. Like this is almost a movie where Lily could actually not exist at all. And you realize that character's only in Nina's head. And there are definitely scenes where she's not there. You know, I think the cool scene that stuck out to me this time is when she comes home with Lily and her mom is yelling at her, but her mom is just talking to Nina. And the first time you see them come in, you see like the front half of Nina in the mirror and the back half of Lily in the other mirror or vice versa. So it's like they're split into one person, you know. But I don't need this like aha montage at the end where you realize like Lily was here at these times and Lily was, and that's when it starts to feel cheap. Like a, I think like Secret Window or like these movies that, you know, like where it's like, oh, right. The movie that stole like the twist from a movie, a very popular movie that had recently come out. So it's like when you get the reveal that, you know, Lily wasn't in the dressing room with Nina or whatever, it's like, okay, like that's fine because it sort of all feels like this is the journey we've been going on with this character. The movie wasn't trying to trick you into thinking this was real when this wasn't. The movie is entirely operating in this, like, this is just what's going on in Nina's brain right now. Whether or not this scene actually happened or whether or not this scene actually happened isn't really important because this is all Nina's experience as she is going on this journey, basically.
Yeah. My favorite little example of how the movie does it in a really effective way is, you know, as Nina's having her big downward spiral, she goes and visits Beth in the hospital, and Beth is sitting in the chair and has the, like grabs the nail file and starts like stabbing herself with it. And the progression is Nina's watching Beth stab herself, and then Beth becomes a Nina double stabbing herself. Nina runs and then gets in the elevator and then looks down and she has the bloody nail file in her. So it's like she probably just stabbed Beth to death, maybe. That's such a fun like way of revealing all of that information. And so I love that. And speaking of doubles, and Maggie, you brought up Birdman. This is the other movie that does this well. Was the movie the first time I'd seen a movie do a thing that I remember imagining like in high school and film school of like, it'd be so cool to shoot a character in a mirror, but somehow not show the camera. And Black Swan was the first one to use visual effects to like paint out the camera in mirrors. And mirrors are such a huge part of this movie, for, again, for very obvious like symbolism reasons. But and Birdman also does this. So that's what the that comparison. But it also speaks to, you know, the way this movie uses visual effects is kind of going back to the kind of duality combo thing that we were talking about earlier, where it's shot on 16 millimeter, it's handheld, it's very verite, but it has 300 visual effects shots, but they're all used in this subtle way that just enhances, again, the emotional state of the protagonist. And so I also just really appreciate it from a technical standpoint of when it uses special effects, when it uses visual effects, and how it has so much fun playing with the mirrors and the doubles and putting Nina's face on different people at different times. I feel like it's a really excellent example of how you can use visual effects in a way that don't call themselves out and only enhance the storytelling. So just wanted to say that because they're very well done.
Yeah. And even real quick, just the shots that are not special at all, but sort of evoke that mirror thing. Two I'm thinking of are the first time she sees Lily from the other train car. Mm-hmm. And then later when she comes out of her apartment and Lily is standing, both times you just see the back of her head. So it's Nina looking at the back of this other character's head. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me of the famous Magritte painting where it's a character looking in the mirror, but the reflection is also the, so we're seeing the back of the character, mm-hmm. the subject's head twice, but once in the mirror where it should be forwards. So it's like, even when it's not doing a special effecty thing, it's still sort of constantly giving you this mirror thing, or like you said, now her face is on somebody else, you know, the woman coming out of the tunnel, or when Lily comes in through the doorway, through the dark, and she's like, who is that? And it's her for a second. And then it's, you know, all that stuff.
Right.
It's not super in your face. Like, it's not trying to drill it into your brain. That was not supposed to be a pie reference. But it is just sort of like constantly doing it. So you're always having that, like that dark mirror kind of theme in your head.
Part of what I love about those, you know, the double moments is if this movie is supposed to put you in Nina's headspace and feel like you're going insane, that's what makes you feel like you're going insane, is when you're not looking at some obvious visual effect insanity, but rather this person looks too much like you, or mm-hmm. the person passing you is weirdly familiar, or it's that unnerving feeling. And it's fun when a director can find a way to use cinematic techniques to recreate that uncanny feeling, because I think uncanniness is a very delicate thing to try to represent on film, and this movie does it very well in many of those wait what did I just see kind of sequences.
Right.
Yeah. Hey guys, Michael here. So a couple weeks ago, I shot a music video with Alex. It was a ton of fun. It's this kind of dark, abstract concept video. And over the course of the weekend, we got a ton of great footage. 2.5 terabytes worth of footage, to be precise. That is a lot of footage to transfer to someone when working with them remotely, especially because a lot of cloud file transfer solutions limit you to just a couple hundred gigabytes. This is where Massive shines. Massive is a file sharing service that lets media professionals quickly transfer terabytes of data to anyone in the world over the cloud. There are no limits on the amount of data you can send, and Massive has 150 servers worldwide, which means whoever you're sending the file to will be able to download it at a maximum unthrottled speed. Transfers are encrypted, so no one but the sender and recipient can access the files. And sending files with Massive is super simple. You don't need a subscription to sign up or a complicated IT setup. Just pay as you go at 25 cents per gigabyte. Sign up for Massive today using massive.io/beyond-the-screenplay and get 100 gigabytes free towards your transfer. That's massive.io/beyond-the-screenplay for 100 gigabytes free. The link is in the show notes. Thank you to Massive for sponsoring Beyond the Screenplay. Well, and so something we talked about in Whiplash is, you know, obviously as all creative people, we can kind of identify with this, you know, the obsessed performer thing. Maggie, I'm curious mm-hmm. if you have any of that, and if that's, do we think people that work in creative fields can appreciate this more or in like a specific kind of way because we mm-hmm. kind of know that crazy self-pressure that we can put on ourselves?
I would say yes and no. And I do think this is the one area where the straightforwardness of the story isn't as effective, because I mean, by the end, you know, she does die, but like she believes she, you know, put on a perfect performance, and like that's the ending. And it's like, okay, well, none of us are actually gonna die for our art. And like Darren Aronofsky certainly is not gonna, you know, die for his art. Like Tarkovsky died for his art, but like, you know, we, you know, like very few people in this day and age do that. Like, yes, there are parts of our life that, you know, we can ruin just from being driven creatively, but I also think that there's, you know, such a conversation of not doing that at least even when I was young, I knew that like no matter what, even though I want to be a creative in the future, like these have to be the things I put first, you know. Like I think at this point, like that's a lot rarer to come by. That doesn't say that doesn't happen, but they're probably more likely to be like real estate moguls than like, you know, aren't it? Like that's kind of what I think is, like, there are absolutely people like that. And there are absolutely people like that in the arts. Like, however, for the most part, I think arts education like encourages, you know, self-care, self-reflection, the things that would like have deterred, you know, like any other dancer from maybe going through this. So in that regard, and again, like Darren Aronofsky, you know, making it bigger than ballet, like, you know, there are a lot of things there that like actually on a personal level, it actually may not resonate with, you know, just an artist, you know, an everyday artist, at least personally. But that being said, there were a lot of things that like he got scarily right. Like, again, like the women's relationship, like it's so accurate. And when you pointed out earlier how, yeah, Mila absolutely, you know, would be supportive of Nina. There's no reason why she wouldn't be. And that's something that like women know, you know, like while we are very competitive, a lot of times we do, you know, try to help each other. And I think a lesser director would have, yeah, gone a different route of, oh yeah, they just like hate each other. And like, we've seen that a million times and it's also like not accurate. So I would, you know, this is a lot more accurate. The mother character also like, ooh, like chilling and accurate and like, oh, wow.
Also, Barbara Hershey is so great.
Oh, she's so great.
This is so good.
She's fantastic. And also, like, the like harassment stuff, like, that was even handled, you know, it was handled pretty accurately in, like, you know, kind of framed, the way it was framed felt very, like, accurate. So there are so many things that he got right that it's like, again, I don't really need as an artist to be like, oh, yes, you know, like, you know, I too wish I could kill myself for my creations. Right. Like
the romantic ideal.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. That part is very romantic, whereas a lot of other aspects are very like scary and visceral and like factual. And yeah, so in a way, I think the characters do a lot more than his like theming of like, you know.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I think there definitely was a narrative at some point, you know, in I think early film school, film brain, me and I know Michael, we've, you know, we came up together through film school and stuff, of the idea like the great artists like do kind of like have to kill part of themselves to make the great art. Like there is a sacrifice must be made to the gods in order to create something amazing. And I think, I like many of us, as I've gotten older, I'm like, that's not important in life. And other things matter more and it's fine.
Yes. And also you are still an artist. So all those things like seep into your art, you know, like I think it actually does show how like, because Nina is obsessed. Yeah. She like has no life. She is alone all the time. Like is stuck with her mom, like is infantile in a lot of ways and like written as in, you know, she in a lot of ways cut a lot of things off that makes her deeply inadequate to do this creative job. Like, you know, she's supposed to be the black swan. Like, you know, she did all the right things from her perspective, but
yeah, there's an interesting kind of parable there of, you know, if you only focus on technique and craft and don't actually have a life at all, then you really can't be a great artist because you have no truth to draw from. You're just focused on the craft in this kind of one-dimensional way. Also, yeah, I just want to, before we move on from the mom character, Barbara Hershey, I think it's one of the best, most, you know, it's great, like, melodrama, almost campy at times, which I love it.
I wrote campy in my notes. I was like, this movie's campy. Like, you may disagree, but it is.
Yeah, campy, but in a way that doesn't feel like it's trying not to be. Like, the camp feels intentional. And I think Barbara Hershey's like performance, it feels like the campiest part of it in the best way, where she's that desperate, just unnerving mother figure who both wants her daughter to succeed, to kind of do what she never could, and also hates her for it, and also is deeply jealous and deeply torn about what she even really wants from her daughter. There's so many contradictions in their relationship, and it's just all there in every single scene with them, and it makes it so uncomfortable.
Right.
And Barbara Hershey's just like face is somehow just amazing to be this like unnerving, domineering mother presence. It's just what amazing casting.
Right. And I think that the campiness, again, as I said at the beginning, like it is part of the story world, because literally every character in this movie is either a performer or Thomas, who, you know, thinks he's God's gift to art, basically. So it's
French.
French. but it's like, so everybody is allowed to give this performance because, like, those people do exist in real life. The people who, like, I was a dancer back in my day, so I speak like this still to this day. Like, why? Like, you're just, we're just having a conversation, you know? But, like, those people are out there, and this movie is just full of that kind of performative person, you know. And Natalie Portman's performance is really interesting because she's also big and performative in this movie at the beginning, but in the entire opposite way. Like, she, the movie, not just her, but like the movie is making a point of how demure she is and how you know, it's like everything is very quiet and very right. yeah, exactly. But then, of course, what that gives us is this transformation into the were-swan, you know, part of her, basically, who then by that finale, you're like, oh my God, this is the same actor we saw at the beginning of the movie, but from a completely different place.
Well, like those shots of her kind of in the side backstage area as the black swan, where she's kind of like breathing with this intensity and her skin is like, you know, rippling or whatever.
Right.
It's just, it feels like a completely different organism than we like previous Natalie Portman in this movie, which is very impressive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Going back to the mom quickly, I felt a lot more empathy for her this time around. Like every watch through I have, because I think you get the sacrifice that she made to have Nina and like gave up her career, and that she just wants Nina to be healthy and happy and is maybe saying, don't kill yourself for this role. Maybe it's better to not. So like, I've always felt that, but I felt it more so this time, and like it was more ever present in every scene. And so I think that's just another layer to Barbara Hershey's performance that I think is really great. And I feel like the mom also introduces the way sound is used in this movie in a really interesting way, because the first time you see, you know, Nina wakes up and then she's at the beginning of the movie and then stretching, and you see the wide shot of the mirror, and then like the dark shadow passes by and like you hear the whoosh,
right,
and it's just her mom, but it's like setting up the, like how the mom feels in Nina's mind. So I feel like I always think about the mom, think about that sound and how she felt at the beginning, and then think about her in that kind of penultimate sequence where she's sitting on the doorknob, like trying desperately to keep Nina from doing this thing that she knows is going to be bad. And Nina just grabs her already broken hand and squeezes it. Yeah. It's like, it's just so, yeah, it's a very heartbreaking transformation that I was really into this time around.
It's interesting. You mentioned the sound of the mom passing, and you know, that's part of the bigness of this movie, is it embraces tropes in sound design from just like straight up horror movies. Like big horror movie sound design is put into these like domestic environments, you know, and you have the kind of like the giggling in the surround speakers behind you, or the kind of the, just these ghostly sounds that are usually reserved for just kind of like a B horror movie. And I love the way Aronofsky just kind of takes all those genre tropes and puts them into domestic spaces, or, you know, the ballet studio. The more I was watching this movie on this time around, I'm like, this is pretty much a straight up horror movie by the end. Like there's sequences that are just like, oh, this is just a movie, like a horror movie scene. It's not even just borrowing from it. It's just, that's kind of the genre it's tipped into now, which is interesting because I never really think about this film as a horror movie. You'd think of it more as kind of like a dark psychosexual thriller or something, but he does go to that full-on body horror, full-on jump scares. Like there's the masturbation jump scare, which is one of my favorite moments. It cuts to the mom sitting there. It really embraces like just really the big genre tropes of horror used throughout the movie.
When we were watching with my partner, and keep in mind we have watched like every horror movie you can think of we have seen. And the part when she like reveals her like bloody toenails, or like, oh, like had to look away. But like, and Darren Aronofsky, like he does it. Like he likes visceral reactions from his audience. And he utilized that to like the umpteenth degree in this movie. Yeah.
Because even the sound of her feet as she's like, you know, touching her feet. Like, yeah, it's awful.
Or in, like when she's at the bathroom, there's like a little bit of skin on her finger. Oh, no. And she's like, visceral is a great word for this movie. That's very much what it is.
Michael, I feel like because you, when you were doing stuff with Soundworks Collection, didn't you interview the sound designers of Black Swan?
We did. Yes.
And you told me, I think they said something about Darren Aronofsky hates when people are in a theater and they're like looking at their watches because they're kind of bored or the movie isn't capturing their attention. And he was like, this movie's the opposite of that. Like, there's no part of this movie where your mind is kind of allowed to wander because it's a slow scene or a quiet scene where nothing's really happening. This whole movie, part of what I love about it is it's just insane intensity and momentum. Like, there's really no part of this movie where you can stop to really breathe for very long before there's a jump scare, before there's something kind of horrifying happening. Even settings like the fundraiser banquet, that's like a nice setting. She's peeling her finger off, or Winona Ryder's right next to her and scaring her. You know, it's there's no space where you're totally safe in the world of this film.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had my phone on me to take notes, as I normally do when I'm watching something for the podcast. But it was definitely the last 25 minutes of the movie where I was like, I kept like finding myself like looking down to write a note and looking up. I'm like, no, I just have to set my phone down and watch the whole finale of this movie. I don't need to take any notes right now. It's fine. Because of exactly what you're saying. Obviously, all of that ramps up in the finale of this movie where things are just like boom, 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 boom. You have no quiet respite conversation moments or anything like that.
I'll put a link to that video. I'd forgotten about it until you mentioned it, Alex. But yes, that was in a previous life. I helped shoot interviews with sound designers and sound mixers. And Craig Hennigan, who's the sound designer of this, had a lot of really good things I remember to say now about how they approach the sound and how much of a storytelling tool it is in this movie, as we've been talking about. Yeah, so that was a really fun video to make.
I'm interested in what everyone thinks of music, because when it came on, the first thought I had was like, oh yeah, ballerina music is boring. but like, I never got bored with it, but I'm curious.
Well, I think what was kind of brilliant about Clint Mansell's approach to the music was he took, yeah, the Tchaikovsky, like just kind of very classical, nice ballet music and twisted it and made it scary. You know, like there's sequences that are just straight up, you know, this is kind of like a big part of the ballet where people are jumping and something, but it's over a scene where Nina's like stabbing somebody or, you know, something horrifying is happening. And he really kind of beautifully takes these elements from the actual ballet Swan Lake. And I think he does alter them and then bring in his own work to make that kind of nice classical music into scary music, which is really fun. And I love how it also allows, you know, once again, part of the bigness of the movie is big orchestral ballet music is big. And it's fun that this movie is kind of allowed to use that kind of a huge score over sometimes like small scenes, but make them feel like really epic.
And right.
It's kind of, it's earned its right to do that because the whole thing is sort of a parable for Swan Lake and is, you know, Nina is acting out the ballet through her story in a lot of ways.
Yeah, you get those horns for the jump scares. They're like, murr, murr, you know. Right. But it's exactly what you were saying. Like the campiness that the movie is like swimming in basically on purpose. Like it's just sort of this decadent, like every aspect of the movie is trying to be big and kind. Campy's not quite the right word, but that's sort of like, we are not trying to do the subtle version of this at all. And then, yeah, his score work is taking all these things together. It's taking this horror element and this ballet piano, you know, kind of motif and everything, and like just putting it all together in the same way the movie is putting all these things together. It's also funny how Clint Mansell is one of my favorite composers, and I listen to his score work all the time, but this is not a score I can really listen to just like while I'm doing work or something like that, because it is so in your face. You know, it's like I don't listen to a ton of John Williams either, because it's like it's the kind of thing that is doing exactly what the movie needs it to do, but then it doesn't sort of, for me, for other people, great, but like for me, it doesn't work as like, I'm gonna put this on while I'm writing or while I'm doing something, because it's like, yeah, I can't take my brain away from what it's doing, you know.
The one exception is, you know, I think the couple of scenes in the movie that really are just pure Clint Mansell are, there's kind of like a, I don't know what you call the theme, like love theme, but more maybe like erotic theme or something, but there is a very Clint Mansell only score that goes with her exploration of her sexuality, both in like the masturbation scene and in the scene with Lily, you know, at the midpoint of the movie. That's a really nice, just there's like one or two tracks on the score that are that background music appropriate Clint Mansell. And the rest of the score is just bonkers, percussive, huge stuff that you really can't have it for writing.
Yeah, that makes sense though, because like those are the moments where she finally thinks about like herself, you know, and like in a way is being selfish. So it's like her song versus like, you know, everyone else that she's trying to please.
Right. Yeah. She's not focusing on her performance and her ballet and her craft. She's focusing on just herself.
It is also kind of poetic in a way that, that this is the first time I watch it where I notice that aspect of it is like, she actually, you know, she does try to like learn about herself, you know, which is, you don't see a lot of movies where like her obstacle is that she doesn't know herself well. And to see her kind of like explore that is interesting. And yeah, I guess it ultimately turns her into a bird, but like that aspect of like self-discovery is like very like interesting, and how she almost like overcorrects by, you know, being evil. And then in the end, yeah, she dies, but she seems to feel like, one, she did a good job, and also kind of, you know, got back at the people that, you know, in her life she was being mistreated by in a weird way.
She kind of lived. She like lived fully, even if it included like, you know, stabbing maybe Winona Ryder in the face. Like she lived fully.
Right. And encouraged maybe for like problematic like reasons and like rushed and pressured to do it, which is probably not the...
Not in a healthy way.
That you want to explore yourself.
Yes, it was definitely not her own her own self-discovery story, which I think is also made very clear, you know, as opposed to like a Spirited Away where it's like, oh, you know, the protagonist chooses, you know, to learn about themselves. This is like under duress and then it goes bad.
Right.
Well, yeah, that's sort of a question I had for you guys is like, what do you think her actual objective or what she actually wants in the beginning of this movie, not from, you know, obviously she wants to be successful at this, you know, her art, but like for herself personally, because we get the sense that there's this sort of like recurring theme of guilt almost, where it's like every time she does try to be herself, then something goes wrong. Like she's under the shadow of her mother, or like she sprouts some body horror thing or whatever. But then when she actually does start opening up, it's like not even by her own volition. Like you said, you know, touched on, Michael, it's like this problematic, like the man in control told her to go do it, basically. But then once she starts changing, then she sort of wakes up and it becomes potentially this part of her that was always there that is now finally being awoken. I guess the question is like, do we get the sense that she did want this kind of thing, or that she was kind of happy with herself, not necessarily with her relationship with her mother and like her entire lifestyle, but like she seems fairly content with who she is as a person at the beginning. She doesn't have the sort of, I wish I could do X, Y, and Z monologue that you get from like from movies where a character is like trying to blossom and trying to find themselves and that kind of thing. So I don't know. Thoughts?
I think for me, that is kind of what makes it like a real horror movie, because you're right. Like, technically, there's like nothing that wrong with her life in the beginning. She says she wants to be the best. You know, she says that out loud. But we can see that overall, like, she's basically, you know, she feels like she knows herself and she like seems happy. Yeah, the film kind of attributes it, I think, to the extreme pressure. You know, there's a lot of focus on everything around her, and especially, you know, like highlighting the mom and kind of explaining about how she got to this place. So, yeah, I mean, in a way, it is kind of sad, but also like true. And especially, you know, especially as a woman in entertaining, like you are told to be a certain way all of the time, 24/7. So in a way, like that is a thing that, again, that he gets right, you know, especially the feeling of needing to do all that. But yeah, it certainly doesn't feel like a journey for Nina. It feels like the horror of like, yeah, we're watching this person like be in a mousetrap that like we all wish that we could get her out of. But because of past circumstances and because of her current predicament and because she is telling herself that these people around me are right. And if I'm telling myself I want to be the best, then and they're telling me how to do it, you know, she believes them and does it. And like, that's horrific, especially as a woman, to watch other women just do things because they are told to do. Like, that is, you know, that's a horror. Like,
I think that is one of the things I have gotten from the movie on repeat viewings and I really appreciated about it, is it's really about the impossibility of embodying these two like age old archetypes. You know, it's like the perfect virgin, like the virginal white swan, and the dark, seductress, sexual, like hot black swan. asking women to somehow be 100% both of those things in these like performance kind of artist, you know, spaces.
Or in life.
Right.
Yeah. In general. Like everywhere. Yeah. It's like, it's impossible. Yeah.
They make a very concerted effort in this film. And I think it's accurate. Is like, I briefly talked about this in my Stanley Kubrick episode, but like any actor, if they're a good actor, could give you both, you know, because you're just acting. But in this movie, like, he is asking her to change. Like, he makes it very personal. Mm-hmm. It's completely personal. Like, she ends up, you know, fucking him to like get the part, basically. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's like they are asking her to change, like not just play two characters, because that wouldn't be a movie. And an actor could do that, but they're asking like her, Nina, like, you need to change to get this role. Like, will you do it?
But also, we're casting you because you already embody a different archetype.
Right.
But somehow you got to be both, which is like impossible catch 22, which I think is very cathartic in a way. Because remember, one of my really good friends from high school, Jennifer, she loved this movie. And she was like, I've never seen a movie just on the surface with like all the symbolism and, you know, whatever, just create the double, like show the double bind that women are in, which is just, like, men want you to be both this and this somehow at the same time, 100% perfectly, which is like not actually possible.
Yeah.
And clearly crazy making.
And drives you to kill yourself and go insane.
Right. And also you see it as like a generation, you know, just like in the giving of the name, like my prince, you know, like you see that it's just a never ending cycle. Like no one ever meets up and everyone is kicked out like the second that they're perceived to not, you know, but it's
right. That's kind of like the extra sad thing about Beth is like, maybe she was able to be this perfect thing, but there was a timer on it and then she got too old and now you're out.
Right.
So like there's that fun thing also.
Even if you win, you don't.
Yeah.
And the movie also makes a point to show, you know, when she's being too white swan, you know, in the rehearsal space, Tomas like, you know, would you have sex with that girl? No one would, like, make her feel bad for being that. Right. But also then when she gets the part, she comes out of the bathroom and like horror is written up. So like also shows that if you are either of those, like it's also bad. Like there's just, there is no correct path through this maze. And that's what leads to her demise.
Yeah.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Why don't we go around and say what lessons we're going to take from Black Swan? Because I think there's a lot of interesting things to talk about. Maggie, do you want to go first? Do you want to go last? Do you have a preference?
I'll go first. I feel like mine's very straightforward, but I think Dernowski would appreciate it. My lesson takeaway is that, like, in a lot of ways, as we discussed, like, sure, it's like a simple story. I don't like saying that because it sounds like I'm reducing it, but I'm not. And I think that helped in the end create like such a movie that people remember. It's so iconic, but you know, everything was very, they said all their feelings, you know. It was very big, simple, done extremely well, and also very emotional, which is, you know, Dernowski likes to put you in emotion. So like those two together created a fantastic viewing experience, whereas some of other Dernowski's movies, I feel like if he had just kept on to that idea of simplicity, it would have helped with a lot of other projects, which again, like, I'm sure is part of the self-doubt that he probably feels, which I'm sure he, you know, wrote into his Nina character. Like, if you're a filmmaker, simple is okay. And like, it can be amazing and oftentimes very impactful because it's very clear what you're saying. And you can still do, you know, very cool, incredible stuff on top of it. And just because something is somewhat simple does not, you know, make it less so. Darren Aronofsky.
Yeah, that's almost become a running theme on this podcast. The weirdest movies that we talked about on this podcast so far have been like Apocalypse Now and The Shining and The Lighthouse and Black Swan. And they all have that, like, you could say what the plot is in one sentence, you know? Mm-hmm. And then there's like The Big Lebowski is the complete opposite of that. Like, no one knows what the plot is no matter how many times you see the movie. But like, that's fine because that is part of the joke of the movie. But like, if you want to make this weird kind of art horror movie, just it's about a person who goes to a place and there's a thing there and they have to deal with the thing. Great. Okay. Like, I get what the plot is. Now you can spend all day doing all your crazy stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm kind of just going to piggyback off of that because that's kind of also my lesson. And as you were saying, Brian, that's sort of always the lesson, but it's such an important lesson. And I think what I also noticed this time about Whiplash as well and Black Swan is, so you have the simplicity and it's great for all the reasons that you articulated, but it also allows for this kind of like cyclical engine of conflict to happen where like the number of spaces are very well defined and limited, the number of characters are well defined and limited, but each film has this kind of flow to the plot where, you know, Nina goes to practice and something crazy happens at practice between her and Thomas or Lily, and that sends her home where then there's something else waiting for her there that then triggers her mental breakdown in some other way that then she takes back with her to the practice space where another thing happens. And so within the simplicity, there is this kind of engine of conflict that happens because of how everything is arranged, you know, on the chessboard that is the plot. And I think that's why it is still entertaining. It's not simple, like there's just one thing happening all the time.
Right.
It's always rotating. There's always whatever's happening is building upon the thing that came before it. And so like that's what makes it accessible and fun to watch and also compelling and super dramatic. And I really appreciated that it creates this kind of momentum also, like you were talking about earlier, Alex, where it's just like every scene like is relentless and pushing something forward. And you know how that's going to, when she goes to talk to her mom about it, like who knows how she's going to react to it. And like, she's going to have to lock the door and like break her arm. Like all these things escalate because of the great design of just the boundaries of the space and the people within it. So good writing.
There's the shot where her mom just like stands up. Like, I think it's for the first time that Nina's like pushing back and she says no. And her mom like rises. And it's just like, it's just such amazing. Is that ratcheting up, you feel like, where it's like a horror movie shot, but in a domestic space with her mom standing. But you're like, oh my God, what's going to happen?
Yeah. Awesome. Well, Alex, what's your lesson?
Basically, I love the way this movie is shot. And it's interesting because a lot of movies that are shot this way, on the surface, I don't love. I think, like, for example, like First Man, I thought did a lot of really interesting things and I appreciated a lot of things about the movie First Man, but I was oftentimes pushed back by the filmmaking where it didn't feel to me like there was always a marriage of like content and approach to shooting that content, where it also was taking the approach of we're doing like a grainy 16mm documentary verite thing as if we're just like there with a camera and seeing what happens. And I think other movies that attempt that can sometimes feel like we just shot this scene a bunch of ways handheld and then we like kind of just put it together in the edit however we could. Whereas in this film, the handheld and the grainy 16mm and all that stuff all feels purposeful and all feels like every shot, when it cuts to the next shot, it feels like the right cut and it feels like it flows, it's natural. I'm not disoriented, I'm not, unless I'm supposed to be. I'm not really feeling like I'm all over the place. And I think I get frustrated with films where it does feel like the verite style is almost more of like a crutch or a just kind of a default mode of like, this is an edgy indie film. It's going to be all shaky cam, all handheld, but not for any particular purpose. And in this film, the handheld, the framing, everything, it all feels like it's doing something in the moment. And it's beautiful, like the way it's color corrected and just like the really high contrast. And the way the visual effects, like you said, Michael, are worked into this otherwise kind of lo-fi environment is all just so like seamless. So it's just a great example to me of how you can use that kind of edgy indie verite style in a very purposeful way, in a way that doesn't feel like it was, you just didn't have any money or it was, you just had to shoot it this way. It's intentional, purposeful, and impactful ultimately.
But yeah, it's not handheld and we're just going to get lots of coverage and then like put it together later. It's handheld, but each shot is telling a part of the story. Like each shot has its story assignment and it's doing it. Cause I agree. A lot of times super grainy handheld is like a tell that like you're a little unconfident and want people to like take it really seriously.
Right.
But this is, yeah, just done expertly. And Brian, what's your lesson?
Alex touched on this a bit, but I just like, you know, a movie like Whiplash is about technical perfection. It is about getting the timing exactly right and being able to be as fast as possible. And that is what I would say 95% of movies about, like, someone trying to excel in their field are about. It's like, you have to get faster, you have to get stronger, you have to get whatever. And it's just, it's sort of cool and refreshing to have a movie that, like, we're trying to be the best isn't about being perfect. It is about letting go, like something we talked about before, learning the rules so you can learn how to break them. Like, do all the things, figure out how to do everything technically, and then where does your own personality come into it? You know, I think so much good art has like a little bit of dirt to it. Like, if mm-hmm. things are too perfect, then they can be forgettable. Like, how many times have you walked out of a movie, you're like, that was a perfectly fine movie and I'm never going to think about it again, right? And then you have like the great works of art where it's, you know, that song has that one chord in it that you weren't expecting, or like that one thing that's going, like the ending of Seven, where you're like, wait, how exactly, like, it doesn't fit into this box.
Oh my God.
Yeah, sorry. That was not on purpose. Anybody can theoretically do the same thing, the same, make the same exact thing if they read a book about how to do that thing and then do it, right? But only any individual person can do their version of that thing and their take on that thing. So it's like, yes, the technical perfection, but also where do you actually come in? Where does your own uniqueness come in? You know, and being able to let go of the technical to let that come in. It's why you should always be a little bit drunk, kids. This movie is obviously a dark version of that. Like, you know, Nina has her, you know, it doesn't go about it the right way, obviously, but I like that is sort of the ultimate theme that this movie is struggling with, is like, perfection is not just about doing all of the things technically correctly and that kind of thing. It's also about living life and like you were saying, Alex, just having life experience so that you can then project that back on your art, as opposed to if all you do is stay inside and practice all day, like that's all you're going to be able to express then in your craft is, this is what my experience is, sitting in my room and practicing, and I didn't go out and get drunk and, you know, have just like a little bit of realness in my art.
You don't have to get drunk to make art, to be clear. You don't have to be drunk all the time.
You don't have to be an alcoholic and die of alcoholism to make art.
And I think that's what's great about the movie on a meta level a little bit, is that it is, as we've talked about, a marriage of this precision and messiness. Like, it is capturing that there is life, there is emotion in it, but it's also intentional. And I think that's why, for me, it still stands out as a really great movie. What have you guys been watching? Maggie, what have you been watching recently?
Well, I did mention Tarkovsky earlier, and I did happen to be in the middle of rewatching all of his movies. Ooh, it's taken me a while, but I just figure it's relevant, because as I mentioned earlier, very few artists die for their work, and he did. But I watched his film Mirror, and I think, one, apt. But two, you know, I always feel like it's good to watch the movies that other directors are referencing. And that's one I feel like, you know, besides the REM Losing My Religion, that's also a reference to that movie. But yeah, directors reference it all the time. So, you know, if you haven't seen it, that's a good one. Probably easier to watch than Stalker, which is also good. Just very long. You know, he likes to pull you out into a field and be like, what do you think of this? And that's just the movie, and you have to sit and think about it. But oppositely, I also recommend F-Boy Island, which is on HBO Max, and is the last thing that I legitimately binged. And just like, what a wonderful character study of just like people, you know, like, wow. And I think those are just as important as crafted narratives on Crafted.
Are we going to get a video about F-Boy Island?
Oh, man.
TBD.
Maybe. I'm thinking about it.
Excellent. That's a great, great multiple options out there for you people. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Awesome. Alex, what have you been watching?
So I checked out Coda on Apple TV, which is the Sundance award-winning film that came out just recently. And, you know, I went into it, you know, Coda stands for Child of Deaf Adults. And it's about a child of deaf adults who realizes she's an amazing singer, which is, of course, the gift she cannot share with her family. And, you know, I went into it kind of cynical. I was like, I know what this movie's going to be. It's going to be heartwarming. It's going to do all the like beats and do the things. By the end, it totally won me over. It was undeniably just lovely and, you know, tear jerking and wonderful. So if you want just like a nice, life affirming, lovely movie, check out Coda.
Nice.
Cool. And Brian, what have you been watching?
Well, if you're looking for the hot new thing everyone's talking about, you've come to the right place. I watched the 1946 film Brief Encounter, which is written by Noel Coward, based on a play of his, I think, and directed by David Lean, who directed Lawrence of Arabia, Dr. Zhivago, Bridge on the River Kwai. The framing of the story is so cool. It starts with this woman coming home from a train station, and she's distraught, and there's voiceover in her head of what she's thinking, and she's just like, we don't know what's going on with her, but we know she's upset about something. Then she gets home and she's sitting across from her husband. And then the whole movie is told in flashback through voiceover of her thoughts, what she wishes she could tell her husband, but can't. So like we're hearing her thoughts about what she wishes she could say, but instead she's keeping it, you know, within. And then the actual story when we go to the flashback is she several weeks ago had met this man who was also married at a train station, and they through happenstance end up meeting each other again. And then they start kind of becoming friends. And every Thursday they come back and they hang out again. And then that turns into dot, dot, dot. I'll let you watch the movie for yourself. But I just like, I found it to be so charming and funny and entertaining. And I've been watching a bunch of older movies lately. And this one just for whatever reason, just stuck out as one that I was just so engaged while watching it. And then I've like thought about it every day since I watched it. So
I love this movie.
Yeah, I can see you nodding along. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So good.
So good.
And
so
it's good. On HBO Max. I discovered their Turner Classic Movie hub, basically, they have on there. Nice. So I've been burning through a bunch of stuff on there. But yeah, Brief Encounter. Check it out. Maggie, second's my recommendation.
Second recommendation.
Sold.
Awesome. I started watching a Netflix show, a French Netflix show called Lupin or Lupin or something, if you know how to speak French. I'm pretty sure I'm saying it wrong. It's basically like a French Sherlock. And so it's like a limited series, and it's a retelling of a French story. I guess there are these old French books about a world famous like gentleman thief and like master of disguise. But it's like modern, and the way that they kind of bring the, you know, the books that it's all based on into the modern world is really interesting. And so it's about this thief who's stealing these expensive diamonds, but it's partially to, you know, like, you know, clear his father's name, who was framed for stealing them back the day. It's interesting. It's hard to explain a little bit, but it's like Sherlock, like the BBC Sherlock. It's just a lot of fun. It's very stylistic. And the lead character is this really charismatic person. And it's fun to see him get into these crazy situations and see how he's going to master disguise, thief his way out of these things, like heisty and all this stuff. Hmm. So it's really fun. I feel like Trisha would like it. So I need to make sure that she watches it. It's very heisty. And it makes me really want like a Lupin Sherlock Killing Eve crossover. Mm. I'm just like, I want to watch cool thief people steal things for fun reasons and be cool. Anyway, so Lupin or Lupin or however you say it on Netflix.
Nice.
All right. Awesome. Well, this has been our conversation about Black Swan. Thank you, Maggie, for joining us. Always fun to have you here. Absolutely. Check out Maggie's YouTube channel, which is simply called Maggie May Fish. Excellent videos, some of my favorites on YouTube. The link to her channel will be in the show notes. We want to say thank you, as always, to the patrons who support the show and make it possible. Thank you to our producer, Vince Major, and our editor, Eric Schneider. I'm Michael Tucker, and I've been joined today by Brian Bittner, Alex Calleros, and Maggie Mae Fish. We'll have all of our Twitter handles in the show notes, so send us a tweet and say hi, and we will see you in the next episode.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.